Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Mr. President, Mr. Lieutenant Governor, members of faculty, and members of the university, I need hardly say that how deeply I appreciate the warm words of welcome extended by you, sir, and if I may be allowed to do so in anticipation, to express as well my feelings at the honor to be done to me, admitting me a member of this fellowship, a university which possesses those attributes of scholarship and service which have won for it renown throughout the world in the field of learning. And you mentioned that you had admitted into the Privileged Society and various members, including the great Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, Harold Macmillan. Well, I should tell you about your fellow alumnus, Mr. Macmillan. I was in London a few weeks ago at the Prime Minister's Conference. At the time that he was inaugurated as Chancellor of Oxford University, he made his speech in Latin, and the influence of DePauw was apparent, for he delivered it with what was called a Hoosier accent. And I must say that everyone was deeply impressed by the manner in which he brought up the Latin pronunciations of another day and generation to the present. Today I'm going to deal with the subject of international relations. But first I do want to say a word, because after all this is open season, on university audiences that are captive, I want to say a word on the opportunities that come to those of each year as they graduate. This university has given many distinguished men and women to the world, trained in those qualifications to which John Milton referred when he said, "I call therefore a complete and generous education one which fits a man to perform justly, skillfully, and magnanimously all the offices, both private and public, of peace and war." And I'm not going to give the advice to the graduating class. If you really want to find out what it is to be a recipient of advice, then you have to secure the position of Prime Minister of any of the countries of the Commonwealth. You don't have that experience among your leaders here, Mr. Governor. But we do it within the Commonwealth. We find out that everyone is qualified to give advice on every subject, regardless of its nature or the knowledge of the giver with respect to the subject on which he gives that information. And I simply say this, that I can best epitomize the enduring values which amount in the years to come, amount to something in the words of the poet of India, Rabindranath Tagore, when he said, "Those enduring values are those where the mind is without fear, and the head is held high, where knowledge is free, where the world has not yet broken up into fragments by narrow domestic walls, where words come from the depths of truth, where tireless striving stretches its arms towards perfection, and where the clear stream of reason is not lost in the dreary desert sand of dead habit, and where the mind is led forward by Thee into every widening thought and action, into that heaven of freedom, my Father, let my country awake. And in anticipation, Mr. President, I express to you my deep thanks for the honor that has been done me this day in permitting me to enter the realms of scholarship of this institution. And to you, the members of the graduating class, standing as you do on the threshold of a new era, challenging and wonderful, I bring before you some views respecting these international problems that are in our minds at this time. The last few weeks have been days of destiny, and even those who have been mesmerized by the specter of examinations must nonetheless have been alive to the international drama of May of 1960. A few weeks ago, we were in a world which seemed to be inching forward towards the goal of peace, a world hungry for freedom from tension and the fear of war, heard suddenly the threatening voice of danger. What are the significances of these recent events? I'm not going to indulge in retrospective judgments about the failure of the summit conference in Paris, for there is no shortage among the experts and commentators to argue the merits of their respective interpretations. I say, however, that what has taken place has shown how fragile are our hopes and how long and hard is the pathway to peace. It may be that we in North America have the longing of men and women for peace. We're psychologically too ready to assume an attitude of optimism. If that is so, the events of the last two or three weeks have jolted all of us into a realistic assessment of the international outlook. And I believe that it is well that the free nations be reminded of the baffling unpredictability of Soviet tactics. Mr. Khrushchev is an expert in the application of the technique of carrot and stick, of alternating smiles and threats. Why he takes these courses, no one knows. But I like to think that a simple explanation is that of the Pavlovian theory of psychology as practiced on dogs. According to that theory, the way to break down a dog is to apply a positive and negative stimuli, in turn to be nice, then unkind, then cool, to feed it, to forget it, to ring bells and flashlights, so that the dog will go all to pieces in a desperate effort to make head or tail of what is going on. That is the Pavlovian theory of psychology applied, as I see it, to the events of today. Well, we pass through these days, and the Western nations have not lost their equilibrium. The day before yesterday, I visited with the President of the United States, and we discussed this matter together. An example to the world of what can be done when nations have a common dedication. And I would be less than frank if I did not tell you, Mr. President, how again on this occasion I was moved as you opened with the national anthem of the Commonwealth. followed it by yours, an evidence once more of that unity that denies political examination, seems to be paradoxical, but nonetheless exists. What of the future? That question has been asked of graduating classes throughout the years. Never in recent years as it is being asked today. Where do we go from here? What are the problems to be faced? What measures should the West apply to their solution? And I begin with the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, of which our countries are members, and on which both are dependent for their security. The NATO reaction to the failure of the summit meeting was one of disbelief, dismay, disappointment, but at no time defeatism. I saw the calm steadfastness of your president in the last few days. I saw it a few weeks ago in the person of President de Gaulle. I have seen it over and over again in the attitude of Prime Minister Macmillan. NATO has not lost its balance. It remains a central, indispensable interest and instrument of United States and Canadian defense and foreign policy. And I have no lack of confidence in it or any doubts as to its future usefulness. But I believe that I express the concern that is the concern of many to build higher in that organization on stronger foundations. And I believe there are certain principles and objectives which would govern this alliance and which need to be re-examined at this time. First of which is this: increased emphasis is needed on the processes of consultation among all the members of the alliance. For all of us know that human friendships fade when they are neglected or taken for granted. We have to be constantly reminded of the fact that NATO is an alliance of sovereign states, that it safeguards our peace, and each of its nations realize that its survival is at stake. And a special obligation falls on the larger, more powerful members to make a reality of consultation and to reconcile the responsibilities of leadership with true partnership. Progress has been made in consultation. More must be done in order to assure a genuine and fruitful state of partnership in NATO. And I simply say this, that there is no substitute for intimate consultation on a basis of mutual trust. That's the first thing. For if NATO goes, our defenses, not only physical, but moral, would disappear. There's a need, too, for a searching reassessment of NATO's future. I spoke with Mr. Herter, the Secretary of State of the United States, only 2 days ago. I realized that in the month of December, he suggested long-range planning for the 1960s to give to NATO a new sense of direction. And there certainly is need and purpose in planning in that direction. And there are so many things to be done. How the responsibilities of the alliance will develop over the next decade. What estimates can be made of changing military requirements? How can we ensure that military requirements are submerged, are coordinated with, and yet not submerged in political aims and objectives? What more can be done to ensure that progress achieved in military cooperation is not discounted by economic or political rivalries which weaken the collective effort? And how can NATO's purposes be explained to the uncommitted nations so as to reduce suspicion and misunderstanding of the reasons the alliance exists and what it stands for? We should study these in a sense of urgency. And I believe this should be done by the NATO Permanent Council, and that after the Permanent Council has done its work with the experts, there should be called a NATO conference of the heads of government of the member nations of NATO, so that those who have the responsibilities of leadership might join in a carefully prepared collective effort to chart new courses for NATO in the years ahead. While these things are going on, what of the Soviet Union? We must not be blown off the course by Mr. Khrushchev's bellicose verbosity, ominous as it sounded day before yesterday. The language of insult is better answered and best answered with restraint. His threats and his military threats have proved ineffective in the past. I don't know why, speaking day before yesterday, he advised that he was delegating to his generals and the authority for world destruction. These are events within the last 3 or 4 days following on the summit conference. These words of his underline the wisdom of strengthening the unity of the Western Alliance. And whatever the interpretation may be of his tactics, a renewal of that state of frigid mutual isolation, we should endeavor to avoid. Mr. Khrushchev must know this, that in a nuclear war, the Soviet Union would suffer indescribable destruction. He ought to know that his words of vilification cannot but damage peace and be self-discrediting. I think today, and it's through the universities this message must be carried to the people, that the West shall not allow emotion following the outcome of this conference to triumph over reason. We must do what we can to keep the temperature down. That's why I underline something that a distinguished graduate of this university, Mr. McMillan, has said: we must not reach in our turn to answer him in the lexicon of abuse. And on the other hand, I am disturbed from time to time that there are those in positions of military responsibility who indulge themselves in the dangerous course of vocal rocket rattling. That's dangerous today, to brandish the symbols of military power. What we intend to do, and again that was re-emphasized in the last 2 days, we intend to continue our contacts with the Soviet Union in a businesslike manner. That's the view of the President, and in that he is supported by the Canadian government. We consider that that course offers the only reasonable avenue for the conduct of relations with the Soviet Union. They never began the summit discussions. Some say, should we have a summit meeting now? Well, I believe it is essential that we pursue whatever fields of contact exist with the Soviet Union in the fields of nuclear weapons tests and disarmament, to continue to negotiate, and to remember that the Foreign Minister of the United Kingdom said in 1918 that if in 1914 the statesmen had continued to negotiate, the First World War might well not have taken place. Well, in the last few days, besides his words of threat, Mr. Khrushchev has produced another version of his disarmament plan. It's elaborate. It should not be turned down out of hand. It should receive careful study in the Committee of Ten Nations, with the United States and Canada members thereof, in Geneva beginning on Tuesday. What is its significance? Will it provide for inspection and control? Will there be practical verification? Naturally, Mr. Khrushchev paraded this with all the fanfare of propaganda effect, but we have to examine it and determine whether in his package, wrapped to appeal to world opinion, there are items of general and genuine value. We dare not dismiss what he has said without careful scrutiny. As far as another summit is concerned, I can only suggest this, that we should not be too hasty to get up the climb again on the way to the summit. A premature meeting at the summit level would be worse than none at all. What I hope is this, that we will be able, by patient preparation, to reestablish a necessary degree of confidence to enable productive discussion among the major powers at the highest level. And to that end, I join with the President of the United States in his attitude on behalf of the people of this great nation, with its vast appointments with destiny in every part of the world, in his message that aggression is not our purpose. He spoke of an open skies proposal, perhaps to be made under the United Nations agency, of a system of aerial inspection to be introduced in order to forestall the terrors of surprise attack. I've done the same on behalf of Canada during the years, and have offered Mr. Khrushchev any part of northern Canada for inspection. My hope is that if this is proceeded with, that Canada will be among the sponsors of the motion to provide for an international effort for the achievement of aerial inspection agreement to guard against surprise attack. And then finally, we have something else that we must do. We've been blessed in a way that few nations have been blessed in anywhere part of the world. No longer dare we follow the luxury of being unconcerned with peoples in other parts of the world. We must realize this, that each day that 250,000 are being born into the world, that in 40 years the population will double, largely in the undeveloped portions of the world. We have a message not only of practical politics, but a message of applied Christianity to make available to those peoples now before it is too late additional programs of assistance in foreign aid. Your land has done much. We've made our contribution too. Indeed, the amount that we have expended on assistance for other parts of the world up to the present since the end of the Second World War for a comparatively small nation in population has amounted to over $4,400 million, or $250 per Canadian, which compares favorably with that of other Western countries, believing as we do that there is no alternative. You of this graduating class are to know peace in your time. There is no alternative than the assistance of less developed nations, giving them that growth, giving them the opportunity to stand as free men, removing from them the danger and the fear of hunger, raising their standards everywhere in the world. That is my simple message to you today. You start along the road to service to your country and the world. My hope is that the world you enter on will be one of peace. That you and each of you will be able to meet those challenges, that fear that touches the hearts of men everywhere, will make your contribution to the attainment of that world which we did not in two world wars achieve: freedom, the right to search for truth, the right of men and women everywhere in the world to a measure of freedom, freedom from fear and freedom from want. To each and every one of you, my best wishes and the best wishes of every American and every Canadian, that you, in your day, will bring about the ideal of peace on earth, goodwill to men, with justice and equality of opportunity, and denying discrimination everywhere in every part of the world. Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you, my fellow graduates-to-be. May fortune be yours always. And may in the years ahead your achievement be the making of a better world for all of us.